Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenayer, today's host for Equal Time Radio, and in general in the new revamped Equal Time schedule, the Monday host. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We've got a great show coming up for you today. We're continuing a series of interviews with people around the continent who are hosting radio shows with similar themes to mine. Jason Bradford hosts The Reality Report, an hour-long interview show out of Willits, California, focusing on peak oil, climate change, relocalization, and related topics. In the second half of today's show, we'll be talking about the book Your Money or Your Life, which features a 9-step process to help you take control of your finances and live well for less. This book originally came out in 1992. It's been updated and reissued. I'll talk with co-author Monique Tilford, plus Jane Dwinell, who's a Montpelier resident who lives the plan. Telephone numbers, as usual here, 244-1777. It's a local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. Also, I want to let you know that after nearly a year of doing this show, I've finally started using the Equal Time Radio website to post audio. Travin, he's been doing it for quite a while now, and starting with my show from last week, you'll be able to download podcasts from my shows within a day or so of each show I host. So the website is equaltimeradio.com. I want to start out by talking about the news that we've heard that State Auditor Tom Salmon is suggesting that the state of Vermont raise revenues for roads and bridges by opening up a casino. John Curran, writing for the Associated Press, says that the suggestion is contained in a letter Salmon has written to legislators. The governor's spokesman, Steve Wark, dismissed the idea. Legislators apparently were pretty cool to it, too, and I'm glad this idea is getting such a cool reception. Curran's article quotes the Reverend Tom Gray. He's a spokesman for the National Coalition Against Gambling Expansion. He says that casinos are bad bets as economic development tools. They come with side effects, including gambling addiction, crime, and other social ills, he said. Quote, do you really want the state to be in the business of making losers of its own citizens? Unquote. The idea of a casino in Vermont is really the opposite of what we need here. I spend a lot of time with Vermonters who are trying to build a local economy, a real economy, based on import substitution, making or growing things here that we now import. People are rolling up their sleeves and farming or installing insulation or solar systems or wind. They're figuring out how to help their neighbors, how to build new businesses. A casino, it's based on the opposite premise. You can get something for nothing is the premise of casinos. At a time when we need to figure out how to strengthen Vermont's real economy, making things we need right here, Tom Salmon is proposing to augment the bogus economy, the economy of lies, the economy of dashed hopes. It's bad enough that Jim Douglas and the 2003 legislature helped so many Vermonters gamble away their grocery money in an expanded lottery here. Have you ever been to one of those casino towns? I lived a couple of years in Eastern California, and going anywhere from there often involved a trip through Reno or Las Vegas. They're sad places. I've seen a guy walking down the street cursing to himself and saying, I never should have come to Las Vegas. I don't know his story, but my father, I'm sorry to say he frequents Nevada casinos. He tells of meeting a crushed, dispirited guy in a men's room. The guy said he came to the casino to make enough money to buy a car, and with what he lost, he said he could have bought a Cadillac. And that was back when a lot of people thought Cadillac was a desirable car to have. And how much would we undermine the Vermont brand by associating Vermont with places like Las Vegas and Atlantic City? When people think about gambling meccas, I think they think about the mafia. When they think about Vermont, they think trustworthy people in the Green Mountains. The Vermont brand is worth a lot of money to businesses here. Let's keep it that way. I think Tom Salmon has been in Iraq so long he's out of touch with what's happening back here. Even if casinos weren't such a bad idea for other reasons, casinos in New England are struggling, shedding jobs, cutting back on the hours they're open and seeing revenues plummet. One well-known Connecticut casino alone laid off 900 people between June and November, according to an AP article in the Times Argus. So I hope Jim Douglas and the legislature remain unreceptive to the idea of casinos in Vermont. They're just a bad idea. Anyway, on to our show. Regular listeners know that I'm doing a series of interviews with hosts of other radio shows with similar themes. These are shows that I listen to via their podcasts and which inspire me. In fact, sometimes I invite guests to this show after hearing them first on one of these other shows. I'm doing these interviews for a couple reasons. One, I think it's important to know that the kind of conversations that we're having here about how to strengthen the local economy at the end of the age of oil, they're happening in a lot of other places. We like to think of ourselves as being ahead of the curve in Vermont, and in some ways, in many ways, we are. but I think it's great to learn from other people confronting similar issues. And the second reason is to let you know that there are these other shows to listen to if you have access to podcasting technology. You know, just a computer connected to the internet will do it, though some kind of mobile device like an iPod makes it easier. Yeah, so if you're somewhere where you can't pull in WDEV for some reason, these shows are good listening. A couple weeks ago, I spoke with John Steinman, who hosts Deconstructing Dinner out of Nelson, British Columbia. Our second guest in the series, and our first guest today, is Jason Bradford. Bradford, he hosts The Reality Report, an hour-long interview show. It's broadcast every other week out of station in Willits, California. Jason, welcome to Equal Time.
Hey, thanks, Carl, and this is a really great idea to have this series. I'm really curious to know what you come up with.
Okay, well, our listeners are standing by, so let's come up with something together right here.
Yeah, well, I do this show, like you're saying, and I don't know who else is talking about this stuff, so maybe after your series is done, it'd be nice to have some kind of article that summarizes who's doing what and where.
Well, good point. That article could probably get some more radio hosts out of the woodwork that neither of us is aware of.
Exactly.
Well, why don't we start out by telling about your show, The Reality Report?
Well, yeah, I moved to Mendocino County in August of 2004, and I was an academic, and I turned to sort of a community organizer. And about a year after I moved here, because of my work, I was interviewed by the local radio station, KZY X and Z. A woman named Els Cooperwriter had a show called The Party's Over, Going Local. It was sort of based off the title of the book by Richard Heinberg. And, well, she ran for political office and had to step out of, you know, broadcasting for that reason. And so I took over the show in December of 2005.
Well, that's similar to how I got here on Equal Time when Anthony Polina, the host of this show, ran for political office and brought in a bunch of us to guest host here.
That's great.
Yeah. So, Mendocino County, that's in Northern California.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about what it looks like around Willits.
Well, Willits is in a valley. There's a series of sort of valleys among mountain ranges here. This is a place where the Pacific Plate has hit North America, and there's a lot of crumpling, uplift, and you've got these coastal ranges. And so there's a lot of folded mountains here. And periodically you get a valley that's wide enough where people have decided it's worth settling, and Willits happens to be one of those. The mountains run north-south, and so we have this big kind of circular valley we're sitting in. We're at about 1,400 feet elevation. The mountains around us are, you know, between about 2,000 and 3,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And a lot of woodland, coniferous forests mixed with hardwoods, and then mostly pasture grazing in the agricultural scene here. And historically, the economy was dominated by logging, the redwood forest here, Douglas fir. So the economy is changing a lot. And they overlogged. And after World War II, you had the loss of a lot of the economic vitality of the local farms. Mm-hmm. They originally were established to feed the loggers, so you had complete diets here. People were growing grains, and they had dairies, and that's pretty much gone now. So it's sort of a decaying farm infrastructure here. It's as well as logging, so it's kind of a depressed area from an economic perspective, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like there's a lot that we in Vermont could recognize from that. It's probably not quite as white as we are right now, though.
No, we get some snow, but it usually melts pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Willits has been a national or international leader in relocalization efforts. I remember when BALLE, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, had their annual conference in Burlington a few years back. Then the Willits contingent, you know, from all the way across the continent, was one of the biggest. There must have been a dozen, 15 people that came over. What's going on there in a nutshell in relocalization?
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? I'd say the people here are very interesting folks. There's a lot of, because it's a small town, people have to take on a lot of roles. So you have you have people who are on each other's board of directors. So, for example, I'm on two boards, and I overlap with people on other boards. And so a lot of the leadership in this town are connected pretty tightly. And so it's very quickly, I was able to get to know a lot of people. And so when I started talking about the need to develop a local sustainable economy and wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, especially oil, it seemed to spread pretty rapidly. And I think the message struck because of the economic problems here. There was sort of the business community looking for solutions and feeling threatened by, you know, mall development even 50 miles away. So they just, you know, there's a certain segment of business community, politicians, nonprofit organization leaders who really got behind this. And sure enough, you know, a whole contingent went out to Vermont. It was pretty amazing.
And I got a glimpse of how grassroots the support for this sort of thing is and for relocalization is in Willits. Was it the movie Escape from Suburbia that had a bit about Willits in it?
Yes, that was right.
One of the people that they interviewed there was, I forget whether he was with the local sheriff department or the local police department, but he was standing there in his full uniform next to his cop car and talking about the importance of getting away from the dependence on oil and building up the local economy. And I thought, wow, when you have the local cops talking about things like this, then it's really gotten into the grassroots.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. His name's Tom Allman. I still talk to him a lot. I was just talking to him the other day about projects we have going on now and how to help him and help each other. So that relationship is still very strong. And, yeah, he pulled out in front of my house and met Gregory Green, the producer and filmmaker. And we happened to have a very nice, clear January day. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, that film crew showed up and the weather was beautiful, but who knows? So it was, this really iconic scene.
So you have this hotbed of relocalization in the listening area of KZYX and KZYZ that the Reality Report is broadcast on every other week, and then you podcast this nationally or internationally. Really, that's the way the web works; it knows no national boundaries. Tell us about some of the things you try to take up on the Reality Report.
Well, you know, I heard your introduction, and I tell you, it's almost identical. I do cover essentially the relationship between the environment in the broad sense, energy as a resource base for human societies, and the resulting pollution, the resulting economic, financial sort of distortions that causes. And then, you know, trying to look ahead and see what the implications are. So I tend to cover more broad issues. I don't do a whole lot of interviewing local people about how they're trying to solve these problems. There is so much at our local radio station where people are taking on that kind of role that I feel like just bringing in key people from around the world is something I really enjoy doing and thinking kind of big picture. So it's been a lot of fun. I learn so much. You know, each time I do a show, I do a lot of research, and it's been a lot of fun. And I've been able to talk to people who I really look on as just, you know, as heroes, really. And so it's been great to get to know them a little bit, even if it's just on the air for an hour, and ask the questions that I want to ask, you know, what I'm curious about.
Well, I guess your background as an academic scientist has really prepared you to dig into these interview topics with real thorough preparation.
Yeah, it's sort of a blessing and a curse, and because it takes up so much of my time, it's like a volunteer community radio station. You know, there's a staff where they handle the news department and managers and technical staff, but the programmers at our station volunteer, and I'm one of those. So it takes time, and I have to worry about burnout. So I can't read a 300-page book from someone every couple weeks and get a great interview together. I have to sort of pace myself and what I take on. But I do a lot of prep. I tend to know my I tend to know the subject well enough that I anticipate what the answer will be, and then I have a follow-up question that and anticipate the answer to that. And so I really kind of lay out, you know, what do I want to get across, and what's a good way of unfolding this.
And this is about a good time to introduce where people can download the reality report. Is Global Public Media the best place?
Yeah, right now it's all kept on globalpublicmedia.com. That's merging with energybulletin.net, which is another great site. And so the archives will always be probably at globalpublicmedia.com, but then new shows will start coming out at energybulletin.net. And they're really sister outlets, so they're going to be fused. It makes more sense.
Okay. Regular listeners may know that I read energybulletin.net, maybe not every day, but very, very regularly. Excellent news aggregator, and
yeah,
it posts some original materials as well. And they have just recently been bought up by the Post Carbon Institute out in Sebastopol, California, where Richard Heinberg, who's been a guest on this show, and Julian Darley work, amongst other people. A lot of good initiatives there, and I'm really pleased for the sake of EnergyBulletin.net that they've come under the wing of the Post Carbon Institute.
Yeah, it's another volunteer group, you know, basically people doing this because they just care so much about it. And so to have them get a little support there is really nice, you know. You have to worry about volunteers who take on something that big burning out. So it's really nice to see they'll get some more help.
Right, and to close a connection, which I realize I didn't close, globalpublicmedia.com, where you can find back shows of archive shows of the Reality Report, is a project of the Post Carbon Institute as well. The numbers here are 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Our guest in this first half of the show is Jason Bradford. He hosts the Reality Report out of Willits, California. And you've interviewed some Vermonters relatively recently. Bill McKibben, who we'll have on next week on this show. Nate Higgins, who's a PhD student at the University of Vermont, I understand, located in Wisconsin these days. But tell us about some of the other guests that you've had on recently and some of the important themes that you've taken up.
Yeah, well, Nate, definitely been a big guest. Also, Joshua Farley of the Gund Institute, a professor at UVM. I really like Vermont. My wife graduated from medical school there, actually. So it's interesting to see how I'm going back to that place now, at least if not physically, at least, you know, tapping into the mines in Vermont. I had a lot of great shows in 2008. It was an amazing year. I mean, in terms of what was going on in the world, it wasn't hard to get material. Richard Heinberg, I interviewed him about Peak Everything, his book. He's just such a good thinker, just so broad. And I also had a two-part interview with David Holmgren. He's from Australia.
Permaculturalist.
He was one of the co-founders of permaculture. And it's interesting, you know, his demeanor, he's similar to Richard in the sense that you just listen to him and you realize how steady he is, how clearly he's thought through this and laid this out carefully. Just, it's not the kind of thing you normally get on radio where, you know, maybe you're trying to, people are bombastic or highly emotional. You know, it's not that kind of talk radio. It's a real sort of, wow, this guy has thought this through and he's just quietly following his line of thought. So I really enjoyed interviewing him, and his website is futurescenarios.org. And then this guy, Philip Sutton, he's another Australian, so I was big on Australians this year. He wrote a book called Climate Code Red with David Spratt. And so I actually had three interviews with him, really going through the case he made in that book.
Yeah, tell us about Climate Code Red. That's alarmist sounding, and from listening to the interviews, sounds like Philip Sutton is pretty alarmed about the current situation.
Yeah, well, this is a really tough subject. He basically argues that we are in a state of emergency, and this is hard to do because when, you know, life is going on, the sun rises every morning, and you just... you just don't know that there's this sort of kind of doom hanging over the planet unless we get our act together. And the, one of the problems is that there's such a lag time between when changes happen at the planetary scale and then when we really notice them. It's sort of like watching a slow train wreck. You know, if you back up and see the data, you see these two trains are heading for a collision, but the passengers may not be aware. And so we're like the passengers on these trains heading towards each other, just unaware, getting our food fed to us. And so he basically stepped back and kind of clearly looked at the scientific information. I mean, it's extremely well researched, and the ramifications are enormous. And what's interesting is that about the same time he was he and his co-author David Spratt were writing this, James Hansen was essentially coming to the same conclusions. I mean, and publicly saying this. So he's a he's the preeminent climate change scientist in the United States.
He's at NASA, and he has famously, he said a few years ago that we had 10 years to bend the curve downward in terms of increasing CO2 production.
Right.
And if we didn't do it within 10 years of that time, then we'd face a really unrecognizable planet, uninhabitable perhaps by human beings. It'd just get us into whole new territory.
Exactly.
And more recently, he's come out and said that 350 parts per million is a important threshold for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we've exceeded that.
Yeah, we're at 387 right now.
Mm.
So, I mean, if you look at Hansen's papers about this, I think it's pretty clear it's got to be below 300, but it maybe was just too hard to even say that. No one really knows how long it can stay above that threshold before, you know, the changes are irreversible. And so this is a big part of Philip Sutton's work is he's actually thinking about, well, what if we realize that we've, you know, it's we have to engineer our way out of this a little bit. So he kind of takes on some semi-taboo topics with respect to geoengineering from that perspective, you know, that this is sort of it's spaceship Earth and there's something gone wrong. What do you do to survive?
Mm.
And I had a follow-up interview with Mary Wood. She's a University of Oregon law professor. And really, gosh, just... I don't know. Her whole demeanor was just so incredible to listen to her lay out the case. And from a legal perspective, basically looking at, you know, the role of government and law as protector of the commons and as sort of a trustee position, and that really it's illegal. It goes against, you know, our whole constitutional framework and the purpose of government to set up policies that make the planet uninhabitable. And so she, you know, all the protesters who maybe get in the way of progress as in the, you know, in the narrow sense, she would probably have a good case to say, no, look at, you know, it's illegal for this permit to be made, or it's illegal for this coal plant to go in.
Well, there's a famous line from a Supreme Court decision that had nothing to do with climate change, saying that the Constitution is not a suicide pact.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that applies here too. When you talked with her, did you talk about the case of those protesters at a coal plant in Britain, I believe it was, whose defense that they were acting in necessity to prevent a greater harm was accepted by the courts?
Well, I interviewed her before that happened, but it goes right along with that. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
So, I mean, I liked your image of Philip Sutton, the author of Climate Code Red, you know, stepping back and seeing a train heading towards a wreck, and the people on board the train, for the most part, are unaware of that, being fed their food, sitting back, reading their books, watching the landscape go by. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about climate change on this show as much as you do on yours, Jason Bradford. I tend to focus more on relocalizing the economy, economic development, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, the forces that are going to hit us in terms of just availability of energy could equally be described as a train wreck that a lot of people are not aware of.
Oh, yeah.
And Sutton uses the term Code Red, Climate Code Red, is trying to get people's attention. You're out publicizing his work with your radio show, and I'm sure in other ways. What do you think is a good strategy for speaking to people about these very, very serious issues that, mm-hmm. as you say, are easy to ignore when you get up every day and things look pretty much like every other day and the sun goes up and so on?
That's a great question. I mean, I try all kinds of strategies. I try just consistency, you know. When people get to know you and they know that you're careful about what you say, you're not going to go away. You can't really be ignored. And usually when people dig into what you've got to say, they realize that it's quite credible. So it's tough. You know, I try to scare people a little bit. You know, I talk about peak oil and the just-in-time delivery system, and supermarket shelves can be empty in a week. And I also talk about, you know, localism as a social movement, and how, you know, if you care about your political independence, then having better economic control and relative self-reliance is a good thing. So I try to play, you know, different people are, I think, different people respond to different kinds of messages. And so I try to just run the gamut. There's so many ways to make this case that I try to use all of them, because mm-hmm. you know, if someone's hesitant about one perspective, another might grab them. And so you find that different people have different predilections and biases, and so I try to grab them any way I can. You know, we're really a lot of what we're talking about on both our shows is simple common sense. It's about acting responsibly. It's about thinking about our long-term security as well as the benefits of having a tighter knit community. And people tend to know those things no matter where they are on the political spectrum. Mm. So it's that's why it seems to be a message that seems to stuck in Willits. So hopefully, I think it will start spreading around the United States and the planet if this message gets out more. And that's why I'm really curious about what you're doing, because I'd like to know where else it's getting out.
Right. Well, I find here in Vermont that no matter where people are in the political spectrum with regard to national or international issues, or I should say other national or international issues, the importance of building up the local economy really resonates with a lot of
Definitely.
People.
And yeah.
In fact, I live just outside of the state's capital, Montpelier, and there were some articles after the holidays saying that the local merchants were, like merchants all over the country, were worried about how they were going to do during this Christmas shopping season.
Yeah.
And they were really pleased that the local people put so much value on shopping locally that they didn't do nearly as badly as they thought they would. Mm. They thought they did pretty well. And, you know, we can have various discussions about the level of shopping that people do, period.
Right,
and,
right.
And how important that is. And in our next half hour, talking about your money or your life, we'll be talking about that. If people, the shopping that people are doing to the extent that they do it locally, then that does make us more secure against, more resilient against whatever changes come down the pike.
Yeah, I think a local currency systems might be very interesting in the future. And the Wall Street Journal had something about that, and so did Newsweek, which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And we've got one in a Time Bank in Montpelier. We've got a Burlington Bread in Burlington, Vermont. And the head of planning in Montpelier is very interested in local currencies, has written a book on them, and
wow.
she's promoting greater involvement, greater use of local currencies.
Yeah, we just started one in Willits, and it's brand new, so I don't know how we'll take, but it's based upon food. It's a food-backed currency system.
And Jason Bradford does an hour-long, long-format interview show called The Reality Report, which is available at globalpublicmedia.com, the archive issues. We usually take about a half an hour per guest, and we're about at the end of our time here. Anything you want to add, Jason?
Well, I just want to say that it's hard to have a balance in this life. You know, I walk around both having a great time doing what I'm doing. You know, I'm farming. I'm active in my community. I really enjoy life. And then I'm also sort of, I have this grief about the tragedy of what's going on. I try not to get too self-absorbed about, you know, I've got it good right now. This is fun. And I also try not to get too upset by the trends. So people need to strike that sort of balance somehow and move forward. And a lot of people are resilient, and we need to keep our spirits up.
Well, right here on this station, after my show, we've got Jack Donovan on with his music show to help you get back into a good mood after listening to some of the things that we're talking about.
That's right.
Well, Jason Bradford, host of The Reality Report, every other week out of Willits, California. Thanks for joining us today on Equal Time.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity, Carl, and have a great second half of the program.
Okay, thanks. Take care. And coming up in the second half, we'll be talking with Monique Tilford. She's a co-author of the new edition, brand new Your Money or Your Life, 9 Steps to Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Achieving Financial Independence. We'll also be talking with Jane Dwinell. She lives right here in Montpelier, and she lives this program. We'll be back with that right after this.